And I'd ask you to please help me welcome Bank Robber Dave from Laguna Beach, California, as the speaker.
My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been an electrical contractor for the last 14 years. No one calls me electrical contractor Dave, right? It doesn't happen up there. Probably never will. But that's okay, I know. The law enforcement agencies know, and that's all that really matters, so I'm good. I want to thank you all for coming to hear me speak. It's really, I feel like I have a relationship with this thing that's awkward. I was told to speak into it, like right here, like this. So it's not good like that? That sounds good, right? Thank you.
Too intimate there.
Oh, I want to thank you all for having me. No one would ever have me before, like for nothing. Because stuff would end up missing, right, in my back pocket, usually. But I have some friends here that I've known for the entire length of my sobriety. I've been sober since August 30th, 1997. And I didn't see it coming. You know, it hit me like a Mack truck right between. I was all in. Right? I heard John Harris say that one time. I gave it my best shot. Don't quit. Don't quit. Get weak. Give it your best shot all the way through. And I'm like, that's what I did. I did, Johnny. Sign me up. But I met this my friend Lee here like that day. Like the next day, they were having a meeting. And there I was, and I've been here ever since. And I can't tell you what a long journey it's been. First off, let me thank people. I have been like the most hectic day all day long. You ever, one of those days when like every single appendage I have is a thumb. Right, everything I've done, like, makes it twice as complicated as it should have been. My brain goes, no, it's supposed to be easy, done. And then the next thing expands and expands and expands. It's one of those days. And I've done a pretty good job about holding my temper through it all, I think. Right? My lovely wife that made this trip with me, Sarah. But I want to thank Debbie for having me. I mean, this is very special. Anytime I get asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am overwhelmed, right? I'm overwhelmed because, for one, this is what happens when I get to speak to you guys. I remember it all. In the depths and the pain and the shame of all these memories that come flooding in is the grace that I've been living in for the last 24 plus years because of what I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous and what God has done through you for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I should have said that one first, because that's how it works for me. I'm supposed to be up here for an hour. There's no way. I'm going to have to hydrate all through it all, I'll tell you that. Yeah, I probably could. Once I get going, I'm like, oh, I'm just so excited, right? There's a lot to tell, you know? It's like having a huge tapestry that's your life, all these interwoven threads in the picture, whatever it is, you know, usually it's evolving, hopefully, right? In my case, it has been. I know it has. But picking the thread and then pulling it and just seeing where it goes, it's a journey, right? I don't have a step hitch. You know, I wish I did. I wish I could tell you, look, I'm going to give you one of those deals, right? But Lee can, right? And it's from the heart, too, right? But I'm going to give you one of those deals that you're going to be laughing until you're crying, right? You're going to be laughing until you're like, don't stop it. And I'm going to keep rolling them on you like Karen Harrison used to, just one after another, just coming down the pike. And then I'm going to softly bring you in. Just magic that happened when God stepped in my life and led me to the wings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to take you to enjoy to what has happened ever since. And you're going to feel my journey, and by feeling my journey, you're going to know your own just a little bit deeper. Yeah. Probably going to happen. for probably not going there tonight. But I will remember what the journey has for me has been, and that's the greatest gift you can give me, because I remember where I came from. I won't go back. I won't. All right, so I was born in Michigan. My parents moved out when I was 5 years old, 1965. We moved to Laguna Beach, California. My dad was one of the first professors hired at UCI Irvine. It just opened up, right? And he's like cutting edge dude, right? My dad's like, this isn't it, right? He's something else. He is a mathematical anthropologist. Led. Chew on that for a moment. Like, what? Like, I don't know what my dad is. I don't know what he does, but that's his title, right? I know the books he's written are like the first couple pages. You're deep into chaotic theory math and stuff, right? Just like, man, what is this? Right? There's no words. How do you read a book when there's no words there? Right? It's not pictures. But so that's my dad, right? Just genius level dude. And my mom's smarter than him. My mom's like Renaissance woman. She just comes to one thing after another, from art to philosophy to teaching to politics, and just destroys it and moves on to the next thing, right? She's always been the glue that holds us together. My dad's the typical absent-minded professor, right? I don't know how many cups of coffee when he used to drink Taster Choice I pulled out of the microwave, and it's just, Dad, you gotta put water in when you do the coffee crystals, right? There's just a black glue. It looks like some bad heroin. So I don't know. Yeah. My sister is she's an opera singer, right? She sang at La Scala in Milan, Italy. She toured Europe with a touring opera group and lived there for like 12 years. She speaks 5 languages. Right, she's a linguist. She's linguistically inclined, right? And there's me. Check this out. By those IQ quotient tests, right? I'm smarter than you. So smarter than you. Alcoholism. If you want to like make it sentient being, right? Like it's real, like it's like the monster, right? Coming around the thing that lives underneath the bed. It's like it had a brain. Alcoholism would just rub its hands in glee if you heard me say that. Oh, you're smart. Oh, I got stuff to work with now. Ate me alive. I did real well. I was really not well adapted kid, right? I was very tense. I had no friends. Well, there's a reason why I had no friends. I don't tell this in penitentiaries, right? I don't tell this when I get to go in an H&I panel and talk to those guys, because they're like, you did what? You are what? But in seventh grade, I was a school safety officer. I had a little clipboard, right? And if I caught you smoking behind the bathroom door, your name's going down on this list, and I'm turning it into the vice principal at the end of every day. I don't know why I got no friends. I don't tell those jokes in the penitentiary. I don't tell them that, right? They're like, man, what's the rat ulcer that, dude? You're a little silly arm rat. You're probably writing stuff down right now, right? But then in the middle of seventh grade, I'm skipping ahead. I'm in the eighth grade out of a class. I'm on the dean's list, right? I'm like, doing what my family does, right? And somebody asked me to go down below the school and drink something with them, right? They said, we got some Kool-Aid, right? But special Kool-Aid. It was Boone's Farm Kool-Aid. That's what I was. It was Strawberry Hill, right? Still making my salivate. They hear that name, the Strawberry Hill. Like, that's where all the dreams are answered. But this is what happened to me. Well, that wasn't the only thing we did, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm talking about the drink. Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, what this alcohol did to me was, I don't remember like this feeling warm, like everything's right in the universe, everything's good, and I'm going to do this for as long as I possibly can the rest of my days. I just remember laughing. I laughed without any, like, I was engaged. I was bound by self before I even started drinking. Right? I grew up in your typical dysfunctional family where stuff went wrong, and it wasn't really, really bad. Hearing everybody else's stories really, really wasn't that bad. But it was bad enough. And I was sensitive enough pre-alcoholic kid that I took those lessons in so deep that I couldn't unlearn. They just became part and parcel of who I was. So I carried on this tenseness, this like my ego was beginning to build a wall. I couldn't laugh uncontrolled. I couldn't laugh like uncontrolled, just belly laugh deep, like being part of and not worry about how I look. I couldn't do that. But I did that when I drank. I did that. It was the most attractive thing in the world to me at that time. It was like, this is what I mean, I don't remember consciously saying that, but by my actions afterwards, that's exactly what I did. Because for the next 24 years, I put it all in. I put everything I had in, on the altar of alcoholism and sacrificed whatever came up in my life on that altar so that I could continue for that to be my God, for that to be the place where I hung all my salvation upon. I hate it when I talk like that in language that really knocks it deeper into my own self, right? I'm supposed to be knocking it deeper into you, right? Not to me. But that's what it was. In an atheist family, I was already, I was already worshiping something else other than learning. My dad believes in the ascendancy of man. Wow. Right? That's pretty good. I'll tell you what, it works for him. It works really well. My dad's moral integrity is such, he's sterling caliber man like I've never met. Right? Just deep, deeply, like moral. Right? And his God and his understanding works well. Mine has to be a little deeper than that, a little more powerful than that. Like my friend, I have a friend who talks about it, his sponsor telling him, that little 9-volt battery you have, the higher power that you got, that's all the juice you're getting out of that God, right? And I'm like, yeah, I need a big one. I need that Tesla wall pack up on the wall, right? I need the one with the sunshine shining on the solar panels and just charging me every day, right? That's the God I need. And that's the one I found. But for 24 years, I put it all in. And in those 24 years, I first moved to every juvenile hall or county camp that Orange County has to offer, even ones that they weren't offering, right? They sent me to a special place called CDU, right? It was See Yourself and Do Something About It. And that was their name, right? But check this out. And you won't, if you know about this place, you won't laugh, right? They were an offshoot of Synanon. It was a pack rat therapy, like, oh my. They knew how to break you down. I need a little more to build me up, though. They didn't have that. So I went through that. I went through all this. I went through California Youth Authority. I went to Oregon Penitentiary. I went to, did I mention that when I drank, your stuff ended up missing? Sorry. I swear, one of these days I'm going to say that, and there's going to be someone in the audience whose house I burglarized. Right? And I know it's going to happen. Right? The odds are just too great, especially if I speak a lot down in Laguna. There's bound to be somebody there. But what happened? I don't know. That moral fiber that my dad has, I'm going to skip a generation. My son has it. He's a good moral kid. And I've gained it. I've been graced with it back. Sure, I always had it. And my mom used to tell me, she's like, David, you're one of the most moral men I know. You're more so than your father. And I was like, I'm deep into my, I'm like, she's talking to me during one of those brief timeouts I had when I just got paroled and before I went off the rails again. Right? She's talking to me in that moment. And I'm like, what are you talking?
talking about, Mom? All the things I've done, those terrible stuff. What are you seeing, right? And she's like, no. You don't get it. You have such a high moral code that when you fall short or somebody else falls short, but it's usually you, I've noticed, right? She knows everything. When you fall short, you can't stand it. You cannot live with that fault between you and what you know is right. That gap is always destroying your peace. And so you throw your hands up in the air and you try to medicate it. You try to drink it away. And you create more of the gap. And it's an awful, horrible cycle, and I hope you survive it. Now, my mom. You know, I'm take it easy. I just paroled, right? I haven't even seen my parole officer yet. But it was, that's what was going on, right? That's what was happening. And so I went from Oregon Penitentiary to, spent the 80s, mid-80s in Soledad, and then I went to, at the end of the 80s, I went to Mule Creek and then Tehachapi Prison. You know, they shit me, but I was actually sober during that time. During that sentence, I was sober. I was living in a state of sobriety. Right? I had a conversion experience, hallelujah, right? And the blood of the Lamb had washed me clean. I don't mean any disrespect with that, but for me, I needed to work with him a little deeper, right? I needed to do a little deeper work to just go, oh yeah, okay, cool, I'm forgiven, I'm good to go, right? I had to still be sober. I was a sober horse beach still. Right? I was just so obsessed. I thought the world revolved around me. Anything that happened, I had to run it through the sieve of how does it affect me? Right? How does it affect me? What you're doing? And I couldn't escape the gravity of my own existence. Was basically what it was. And after that, I paroled, immediately fell on my face out here in the world, and I didn't know how to live out here. I didn't know how to live in a world where I always felt apart from. When I was in there, I felt apart from too, though. It's like I was slightly better. Right? My ego made me slightly better than these fools. Right? And they could see that. Right? And I didn't have an easy time at first because I hadn't learned to hide that little attitude that I had going. They call me professor, and it wasn't complimentary, right? In the same way, right? But out here, like all you people listen, you drank like I drank, and you felt like I felt, but you didn't go to prison. You learned somehow. It just seemed a magical thing that somebody could live out here in this world. I didn't know. I was so lost on how to do it. Really, that was institutionalized. Well, that's pretty much the nature, you know. Lots of other stuff you could put in there about why that all happened, but that's what it is. It's too slight. I know how to live in prison. I know how to live what people tell me what to do. I don't know how to live out here where it's up to me. I have no idea. And then I robbed the bank. You think about, you know, God, there's so many bank robbery movies, right? I mean, from on and on and on, right? The Ellinger, man, Pretty Boy Floyd, it's like litany, the bank robber. And then Hollywood got involved. It's like, oh man, that movie Heat with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, right? Mine wasn't anything like that. It was far removed as that as you could imagine. I would have tellers looking at me in sorrow, like, are you sure you want to do this? Because they could see the utter miserability of my existence, right? Because it was on my face. Man. My headlines were, mild matter man robs bank. Oh, gee, right? Thanks to stuff right there. This bank robber, fool. This just trips me out, right? When people say, hey, my bank, he robbed banks.
I'm like, do you have to talk about my shame every time you introduce me? That's so pitiful. I was doing foot escapes. I'd run to somewhere where there were bushes or somewhere I could hide for a moment and quickly change clothes, right? I'd be wearing a blue sweater, and the next thing you know, I got an orange coat on or something, right? Just change, just get out of the clothes, because they're looking for the clothes immediately. They're looking for color immediately. They don't know what I look like. I walk right by a bank that I just robbed, and I just change clothes and put a different hat on and put glasses on or something. Oh, what happened? Why'd you ask somebody just robbed the bank and I saw him run down the street? I said, you saw him? Yeah. Walk on. One time in Eugene, Oregon, I robbed a bank right down the street. It was on 7th and Polk. I don't know what that means, right? But I remember the streets. It was 7th and Polk. There's a police station right around the corner. Who knew? I had no idea what's going on. I robbed this bank and I had this girl that I'd just met, right? And I said, hey, I'm going to go do something, and when I come back, I'm going to change clothes real fast, and you're going to walk me out of the neighborhood because I don't know where I am, right? She goes, oh, okay, all right. I can't rob the bank, came back, changed clothes, stepped out on the sidewalk, put my arm around the girl, and the cop pulled right up next to us. All right. Right? And I'm like, what's going on? And he starts talking to her. He goes, Patty, Patty. And I'm like, she knows her, right? probably not good, right? Patty, 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 did you see a guy dressed like? And he described the clothes that you could see underneath the bush, right? You could see him. All you had to look, you could see him. And she goes, and she froze, right? She froze up. She realized that she was out of her league at this moment, right? And the cop, so I stepped in, and I was like, sir, what happened? What's going on? Right? He goes, oh, you just robbed the bank. I said, well, that guy was running for the, I think he's going to the phone. The guy had just gone across the street to make a phone call. One of those old phone booths. He looked at him. No, it's not him. He goes, I got to go. And he took off. I said, come on, Patty, let's go. And she walked me out of the neighborhood. And that officer, my hat's off to him. I salute him because he reported later. You know, once they saw my bank robbery teletype photos for the bank, he goes, oh, shoot, that's the guy I stopped on the street, right? And he told him, right? He told him, I saw that guy. I stopped him. Didn't recognize him as a bank robber. He had different clothes on. Can you imagine what he gets at break time in the police department? Can you imagine the comments? Right? See any bank robbers lately? Hopping off with any bank robbers lately. So funny. So I ended up with a 151-month prison sentence for robbing. Well, they charged me with 4 banks. I robbed 8. It was, like I said, I got $237 once on a bank robbery. Could have got that from car burglaries, right? Or, you know, corner liquor store. Anyway, it wasn't really working out. This career was, it was time to end, right? And go to a different career. In the meantime, though, I had to do 151 months. And I remember I told you I was jumped ahead in algebra class. I figured that out real fast. And I was like, that's 12 years, 7 months. Did you read my transcripts, right? This is unarmed bank robbery, right? Never had a gun. Never happened. I was just such a mess. I knew I was such a mess. I didn't want to inflict more of my mess on anybody. I didn't want the collateral damage to spread further than it already had. So, never had a gun. You know, I had experiences with guns before that I didn't want to wake up to in the middle of the night again. I didn't want to go down those roads again. The consequences of my actions were beginning to build up on me at that time. And when I started robbing banks, you would think that, oh, really? Oh, so you start to feel the weight of your actions, so you start robbing banks then, right? Well, yeah, but without them. That didn't fly, right? You take the money, they're going to punish you. So they gave me 151 months. And I was in Sheridan, Oregon, right? They have a FCI, Federal Correctional Institute up there. And I found out I didn't have to stop. Right, I didn't have to stop. Once I got over my idea of escape, right, because I was like, man, I can't do this much time. Right, there's just no way. Once I got over that, because they have like machines that drive around and shake the ground to collapse any tunnels you might be building, and they have a roving rope. They have three layers of fences with sensors on every one of them, and they don't have guard towers there at that FBI. So instead, they just have roving vehicles that are like. God knows the armory they got in there, right? You're not really getting out unless you got a lot of outside help, or just really a lot more devious than I am. So I gave up that idea in favor of the idea that I didn't have to stop. Right? There was more stuff going on in there from Pruno on down that I didn't have to stop. Right? Until I ran out of everything, and I was about 2 years into this 12-something-year sentence, and I ran out of everything, and then everything hit the yard, but I had no chain. My chain was already played out, right? I had no more credit, right? I owed everybody, I wasn't in trouble or anything, but I couldn't get any more. So, I realized that, imagine this, imagine we're in the chow hall, and then there's the officer's quarters right there with guys in suits or food service managers and all the guys. They're in the front in glass booth, and up above is the sub-ceiling, and that wall is a shared wall with the commissary. In the middle of the day, I got up, I was the repairman for the entire kitchen, right? And I was the HVAC, emergency repairman for the entire penitentiary. I had the run of the place. So I got my carts, I got my tools, and I got up in the substation right above where all the suits are and started beating through the commissary wall, which was a poor cement wall with rebar in it with a hammer and a cold chisel, right in the middle of the workday, like 8. I think it took us from about 8 in the morning till like almost 10:30, right? For hours we're beating on this thing, beating into the commissary. Burn drives the commissary, right? Over the top of the officers that are sitting there. And they came up the ladder once, right? I go, why are you making all this noise? And I had this whole fake scenario built out for them, right? I said, see that refrigerant line? We're close to that wall. There's a leak somewhere in there. We're losing refrigerant. You want to explain to the warden why all the food has gone bad? I got to fix this. I got to beat apart. And you could see where I've been beating at it with the hammer, right? It was just like, you are one devious. I am pretty devious. I'm not devious enough to figure out how to escape from that place, but I was devious enough to figure out how to burglarize the commissary while I was there. So I got away with it for one day. One day. And in the morning, when they were calling my name, like with a lot of urgency on the intercom, the whole prison intercom, boy, report to the right. I was like, okay, here they come. And remember all those notes I told you I dropped on people? Smoking. Well, there was 11 notes on the lieutenant's desk saying, boy, did it, right? They were just mad that they didn't do it. But anyway, I spent the next year of my life in both DSEG and ADSEG, administrative segregation and disciplinary segregation, because I was under arrest while under arrest, and then while you're under arrest, you can get under arrest again and go to DSEG, right? And I kept doing that because they wouldn't let me go. They just kept trying to get me to tell on myself, but I wouldn't tell on myself. They didn't catch me or anything. They were trying to try me for it. They were trying to send me out to court and give me a burglarizing federal government charge, right? But I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't confess. And I ended up in there for a year. A year in a very small place. No yard. Well, they get a little dog runs, right? It's like you can touch both sides like this, and they're like, I don't know, from here to that sign, you can pace a little bit more than you can in your 6x8 cell. And that's about it. That's your recreation 3 times a week for an hour. And, now at this time, I'm in my middle of my 5th prison term. Right? I'm a 5-time loser. My brain is still intact. Right? I can still see how 1 + 1 = 2. Right? I can still see the simple logic of why these things keep happening to me in my life. Why I keep putting myself here.
Because I'm chasing drugs or drinking to the exclusion of all else and anything else. All that mattered by this point. All humanity was gone from me. My friend Shane Emby, he tells me never tell the story, so I'm not going to tell the story, but I did really bad things to people, right? In prison settings and stuff, you know, your typical prison story BS, right? But sometimes that's just real. And I'm going to tell you, I've had it happen to me. I got stabbed in the eye in a bar fight, and I committed stuff on other people at the same level, right? And for me, doing it to somebody else is worse than having it done to me. I can't do something to somebody without it imprinting it on my own soul. Can't. So I see all this, right? I got to hear, think about this, right? Really consider the consequences of my actions. Or I can figure out one place in the cell that they shake down every day where I can make batches of Bruno for the entire year I was in it and never got caught. No choice, right? I made Bruno for the entire year and kept it rolling when they shipped me to my next destination, which was Longpole Penitentiary. And they shipped me there because I finally had enough, right? And I said, I'm not moving cells. They want to move your cells every 2 weeks, right? Because they're very security conscious, right? And somebody thought, if you could think up an idea and put it in for as a, you know, rule change or something like that, your career is on fast track. So all these bright Edward people, you know, correctional officers trying to figure out, right, what's a bright idea. How can we think of something different? Well, they thought of this one. Well, what if they're tunneling out? What if they're tunneling out and we don't know it? With the plastic sports we give them every day to eat with, right? Right. Okay. So if you move them every 2 weeks, you got to start again. So that's what they do. They move us every 2 weeks, so we have to start tunneling again. We just take over the next guy's tunnel, though. It doesn't really matter. I was tired of it though. I've been in there for a year and they're not doing anything with me. I'm saying, I'm not moving, right? I'm not moving. So these people ended up, when you tell them you're not moving, come get me, copper, right? They do. And they're smiling when they said, oh, you're not moving? They start smiling. I didn't really like that. I really didn't like that at all. But I made it a little hard for them. I made it a little difficult for them. I put a sheet up first thing so they couldn't see in there, right? And then we had some lotion and some water and stuff, squirting all that all around, and right, my bunk is up on the top rack, you know, his eyes like this. And, oh, what are you doing? What are you doing? I'm like, don't worry about it. They'll open the door. Tell you to get out. Just get out. And so they did, right? And they come in like this. They come in, Timo, right? Real deep, husky voices because they're the biggest corn-fed wolves you've ever seen in your life. They just come barreling in, right? One after another, and they're armored up like no one's business, right? First guy's got a shield, right? All guys behind them are just ready and pushing. They got batons and, you know, they're serious, right? You can't see any flesh on them. They're like Ninja Turtles or something. They're all just like, we're getting it. I think they're all speed. I swear, man. There's too much energy there, right? So they come in and a couple of them slipped, right? They stepped in the lotion, down they went, and heap, right? But what I forgot was once you're in the heap, now you know where I am. Because I wasn't even, I was underneath the bunk through a little, like this big little opening where I had to exhale, right, to get myself in behind the bunk where they welded in a shelf underneath, right? So I'm braced in there, right? I got plastic Bisqueen over my eyes. I got a wet towel over my mouth. I'm ready for the tear gas, right? And I'm totally like braced in, like they cannot get me out of there, right? They can't. And they're reaching in, trying to grab stuff off my face, and I'm pulling their gloves off. They don't want to reach. They don't want to reach in anymore after that, right? And man, it was. I want to say it was like, you know, the rest of the place was going off,
right? The, like, all the rest of the hole, they could hear everything happening, right? And they're like, oh, man, they're kicking their doors, man. They're flooding their cells out, right? And the two guys lit their mattresses on fire. It's like, you're in a 6x8 cell, bro. Don't light your mattress on fire just for a show of solidarity, right? Because then they had to go rescue those guys. But it was like, you know, rage against the machine or something, you know, the moment we were having it. And, but it was really creative because I was screaming like a little girl the entire time. Right? They thought the officers were killing me, right? They thought they were like exterminating the inmates or something. I don't know. But they were very professional because the moment the camera turned off, I knew what time it was. Right? They got a video too. I'd love to see that video. Right? They're videotaping this whole thing, and then the video's gone. They can't get me out of there, right? They couldn't get me out from underneath that bus, right? And then the video's gone, and I know what time it is, right? Here comes the broomsticks, and, right? It's going to get really painful now, right? So I'm like, okay, I get it. Uncle, right? And I claimed a moral victory, because that's morals are very important to me. I claimed a moral victory because I made them all get out of my cell and shut the door. You know, it's like, man, I don't want to get hurt getting out from underneath this book. It's really difficult in there. I'm like contortionist to even be able to get in there. So they did that. I came out. They jumped on me and they opened the doors. You know, they rolled my eye. There's this little technique where you use your knee on the back of someone's head and just roll his face a little bit like that, and you can give him a nice little mouse right there. He's an eye, right? He gave me a little mouse. That was it. You know, that was it. They're very professional. Give him that. You know? But that got me shipped to USP Lompoc Federal Penitentiary, right, which was known as, man, like this was the only level 4 penitentiary on the West Coast at the time, right? Before they opened up Victorville and they didn't have Colorado then, right? So I don't think they had. They may have just been opening up Colorado in 97. Anyway, on the absolute coast, this is the only one they had. So now I hit the big house. Right? I care less, man. Five-time loser. In order to care about something like that, I would have to care about me. That's long gone. I'm just existing. And I was in trouble before I was even there 30 days. I was in trouble. I was in the hole again for 90 days possession, right? And I let them come run up on me and take it from me. Oh, man. This is a while living that down, right? Because I was like, I froze like a deer in the headlights, like, no, they're not coming for me. No, then, oh, yeah, okay, that's yours. The hole you go, right? I got out, and I got in, and this is how God works in my life. He put me in the cell with a dude that had more game, right? More, like, move, more prison moves as far as being able to get what he wants with nothing than anybody I ever met, right? This dude, man, I was doing something every day for 3 months. I was drinking or something else for 3 solid months. And I would be all drunk. We'd be sitting there in the cell, right? And I'd tell them about my experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'd had a few by this time. Right? Not of any lasting nature, obviously, right? And I didn't work the 12 steps of AA, so really I was loosely in the fellowship of AA. I was not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Big difference. Worked the 12 steps. Man, this is great, but this is secondary to how much change has come in my life. I love the fellowship, right? And the fellowship reminds me what I need to do. Work the 12 steps about Alcoholics Anonymous. Me and Sarah were talking on the way up here about a few sponsors that we know that they have so many sponsees, they don't have time to work the steps with them. I don't know how that works. I can't figure that one out. It's the stuff that changes me, right? So I'm in there with this dude, and I'm talking at night with him, all drunk about, yeah, one day I'm going to want to be sober more than I want to be drunk. I know it's coming. I know it is. I don't know what the hell I was talking about. You know what I mean? I was just talking from a lost place. I'm just trying to be, it's always something of, by this time I cannot remember what it's like to feel okay about myself as a man on the inside. I don't know what that's like anymore. I'm so far removed from it, I don't even understand what I'm removed from. I don't even know what's missing. I have cottonmouth issues right now. I must be either telling a big fat lie or about to tell the truth. That's one of the two. So that happened to me. Some dude named 6'8 came and put something in my hand and said, when can you pay me? And without a moment's hesitation, I said, 2 weeks. And he moved on and I took what he gave me. I crossed the line in the sand I had never crossed before. 6'8 was a member of another race, right? And he was like the biggest human being I've ever been in physical contact with. But I think he's embarrassing. He was a big dude. He was a kid. He was like 19 years old. Right? But 6'8 was just a description of his height. This was even bigger, right? He was like, oh man, he would come in the cell, like he would have to scrunch down a little bit and then expand on you trying to get his pay, right? And I'd be like, got you, bro. I got you, man. Don't worry. And I did. I paid him. But when I woke up that next morning, I was like, man, that doesn't even make anybody sit step, right? Oh, one time I said to him, I would pay this guy. And I did pay him, but I never said. I'm not putting that on my fist. I got 24 years of really gnarly stuff put on my fist. I ain't got enough paper for stuff like that, right? But that little thing, that last little thing I did was just straw that broke the camel's back. Like everything had just been weighing and weighing and weighing, and I couldn't carry it more than one moment. And I woke up the next morning in that place that my homeboy Chuck C talked about. That morning, I couldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. I was so done with me. And I'm not a suicidal dude, right? So I was like, there's only one thing I know. Abandoned myself to the arms of my fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went looking for meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in that prison. I walked up to a dude named Steve, because I just met him again, right, on Zoom. I walked up to this dude, Steve, that had something different going on, right? He had a full locker, like the entire month. He didn't give it to the Pruno dude. He didn't give it to the, you know, the gamblers, right? He wasn't anything, right? He's just calmly taking care of himself, and he had stuff, right? And I asked him, like slow voice, right? Not only am I a bank robber, but I burglarized commissary. Right? And there's so many dime a dozen bank robbers in there, pitiful, low-bottom bank robbers like me. But if you burglarize the commissary while you're in prison, right, you're a next level, that's rock star status, right? So I was like, man, you know I burglarized the commissary, right? While I was in prison, I did that, right? That's things I bragged about in my life. And this dude, Steve, he goes, bro, you've no idea what you got waiting for you. You've no idea what's coming, man. This program is, and you start getting that little AA smile, and his voice rose up a couple octaves. I'm like, okay, bro, I'll be there. Out. And I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next day. I heard a group of men talking about becoming men of dignity and honor. Just some new words for me as trying to reflect them about, to me, like, me? I could be that? I couldn't. I was in that yard for 7 years. And for 7 years, I was a pom-pom waving cheerleading member of Alcoholics Anonymous in that prison yard. The fellas out on the baseball field or wherever I was going to play squash, pretty good sports. They'd see me coming and they'd be like, oh man, that's David. Because I was proselytizing the world. And they were my world, right? That's all I had was convicts to work on. Man, I feel sorry for those dudes, right? I had all the answers for them, right? I mean, they would get mad at me, like, literally almost physically threatened me to shut the heck up, right? And I'd be like, all right, you know where I am though, and we're waiting. We're waiting. You got nowhere else to go. And like, what did I just tell you? Right? I'm like, okay. Know where I am. So, what I found, and my friend Tim W. calls it, is we refer to it as the golden age of recovery in USP Long Pole Federal Penitentiary. We sponsored each other. We walked each other through the steps. I told my deepest, darkest in the gym, right, with 500 crazy maniacs running around semi-supervised in the gym, right, and I'm over in the corner with my sponsor. I'm reading my stuff to him and crying, right? Don't cry in prison. My nickname was Crying Dave. It fell hard on me when I got sober. Like, all the stuff that I held in here for all these years came out. Levy breaks, bro. It breaks, right? And it broke for me. And I'm sitting there crying, giving them everything. The stuff that I was taking to my grave with me. Because it just can't... Yeah, I know there's names for it, but I did it. Right? It's me. That's my special thing. I know that somebody made a name for it. Sorry, maybe somebody else. Oh, that's why they made names for it, right? Because that's what we did. We did weird, crazy stuff when we were drunk. So, my sponsor knew better, right? And he started telling me, like, look, man, those are the things that are taking you to the grave with him. Those are the things that are killing you, man. He said, check this out. And he started running it down, what he had done, right? And I was like, I'm not the sickest man on the face of the earth. He is, right? It's him. He's the one. He freed me. He freed me. The gifts that we give here, the sacrifice of self, and that just like fearlessly say, man, look what I did. Facing up to what we have become, right? And moving on, and hopefully upwards. That's where we want that, right? Or sometimes reverse that. I am so happy to be on this journey. I'm so happy. I learned so much in prison. It was 7 years I was in prison in that group. You know, people would die. Our group members, several of them, like four or five of them, like committed suicide. Or were died under shady circumstances in the hole, as they said it was a suicide. I don't know. Right? It's not my business. But if you're in prison, you don't walk in. It's not like walking into a recovery center, right? Or your local law club, right? Negative stuff. It's negative things that go on. My friend, me and Shane, was one of my best friends in there, and we were playing tennis one time. We used to play tennis at lunchtime instead of go to the chow hall, right? Because the chow hall really wasn't worth going to do anyway. And so we played tennis. We were all into tennis. And one time we were about halfway into it, and he's like, Dave, we gotta go. I'm like, God, it's early. Not even rang the bell yet. We don't gotta go back to work. And he goes, Dave, turn around. And there on the other side of the fence behind me was a guy dying. Right? He's just been stabbed to death, and he was spiraling right behind me. You know, I watched two friends of mine, one of whom I really liked, right? He worked on we had a little crew at an electronic cable factory, and I was the lead man on the box crew. We built these electrical distribution boxes, right, for the military, right? This guy's been working on, he's a good dude, right, seemingly, right, real, he's one of us, right, real personal, real, like, characters, like, I mean, I could see the fingerprints of God on him. I knew he was a child of God. For me, sometimes that's hard to see people. I have to work at it. That's what I want to be. I want to be the guy that sees that in everybody. But I saw it in him anyway, and I tried, really tried with Joe. And Joe and some other dude were paid by some dude in the hole, or not paid, but like given the green light, right? Like this dude's name's in the hat, and he's got And the two of them went and killed another dude, or another friend of mine who had been in the program, kind of. He's come to meetings. Right in front, like, right down the aisle from me. Like, as the last row. I'm sitting here, unobstructed view, watching it all happen. The cops came and got me. Because I was 5 years sober when I witnessed this. I wasn't the same man anymore. I was not cut off from and disassociated from and, yeah, better him than me. Right? I was beginning to be connected to my fellow man. And to watch my fellow man do that, I lost it, right? I lost it. I started screaming in these big racks of supplies. I tried to tip them over, but I underestimated my crazy strength and I couldn't tip them over. But I was trying, right? And the cops, one of the officers sent us report said, Boyd was observed running from the scene. I wasn't. Like, whatever. Anyway, so they came and got me and they got the guys that are involved and you have been I mean you as in Alcoholics Anonymous has introduced me to portions of me that I never knew existed, that I didn't know that I had in me. I didn't know that I was a child of God. I didn't know that all the good that's in me now, that I live now, that comes out in the actions I take on an everyday basis, and are increasing. I didn't know that these things were there. My mom's name was Rosemary. Is Rosemary. I'm Rosemary's baby. Right? That's who I've always been. That's how I've always felt about myself. When I fell into the arms of AA this time, I'm just an alcoholic. That's all that's wrong with me. It seemed like a huge step up. Right? My self-esteem level, I mean, it was still pretty negative, but it rose up like a lot just by that knowledge right there. I'm just a poor, lost soul who went this route looking for the spirits of alcohol when he just thought I was supposed to be looking for the Spirit of God. That works through all of you. That works through my fellow men. So I paroled in 2005, 7+ years of sobriety, and immediately joined H&I. Like, immediately. The example that I was given by the H&I members coming into the Longpole Penitentiary just tattooed it in my entire psyche. I am going to be a member of H&I for the rest of my days, and I'm going to stay sober. So I did that. I had one chunk. I had several brief stops and starts lately, right? And I haven't been in there a couple of years now. You know, COVID part of the reason, but for 10 straight years, I was going into the penitentiaries where I used to be an inmate at. Do you want a significant substitute for alcoholism? For alcohol? Try that. Try going back, fully armed with facts about yourself. To talk to the alcoholics who are still there where you came from. Man, the first time I walked in, I had a suit on, not near as nice as this wonder that my wife bought for me for my birthday, but I was a nice suit, right? The best that the thrift store had. And I walked in just floating in. I was in the East Yard, Chino East Yard, and I was there in 89 for 6 months. I walked in, right, and I'm just like, man, I can't believe this. And the grill gate closed behind me, crazy, and the drunk doing shoes, right? And we're waiting to be escorted to the chapel where they have the meetings. And there's this one old sergeant over the corner. He's just got me, right? He's just pinning me. And I was like, oh, shoot, he knows. And I'm like, no way, I got my approvals and I'm 10+ years sober. What does he know? Right? Whatever, right? He came over to talk to me. He goes, sir, good thing. Sir, I just want you to know that these guys in here don't want to listen to anything a man like you might have to say. I'm like, and he said, they're just here for the coffee. It's a taster's choice. No one cares about the coffee. They wouldn't let us bring in a little coffee to them. So I almost corrected her. Right? I almost explained to them, why they just might listen to me. And I'm like, eh, whatever. So I just told them the truth. I told them, well, I'm here for me. Here for me. And I went in and I talked to these guys for the first time. It felt like I was sitting across looking at a room full of me. A room full of guys that hadn't made the decision, and I weren't on the other side of the coin of making the decisions to turn the world and their lives over to the care of God as they understood. And so I could talk to me. I talk in prison so much different. So much different. Matter of fact, I've been pulled up on it by the prisoners, right, that had issue with my salty language. Right? When I was talking to him, I was like, oh, my bad. Don't swear at those elders. But it was the greatest thing, and it is still, because it's coming back, I'll be in there again, the greatest thing I've ever done. The greatest thing I've ever done. And to be able to welcome those guys out the gate when they come out, right? I've put several of them to work. I've driven them home to their families. I've picked them up from the gate, driven them home to their families. And told them, man, I'm still here and I'm still doing this. And this, my life is a testament for what you guys tell everybody about all awesome. And I give that to those guys when I go in there. I do my best. I ask the Lord to give it to them. It doesn't always work out. It doesn't. Oh, man. I've had a most incredible 2+ years, the last 2 years. For those who wonder what my life looks like now, I've been to Europe. I've walked the hills of Ireland. I've walked the cliffs of Moher. I've been on the Aran Islands and seen the ruins of Dun Angus with my beautiful wife. She was my fiance at that time. I've met her whole family out there, right? Because she's one of the Midas girls, right? And the family's out there still. And they all love me, right? I didn't think it was necessary to tell them my whole history, right? Let's just enjoy me as I am now, right? That's so fun. But I did meet with our big Saturday night speaker meeting in Limerick, right? But it was like 20 dudes, right? 20 people. That was the big meeting of the week. And I got to tell my little American bank robbery story, right? It's just like, oh, you're a wonder lad you are. What a crazy Yanks you are out there. Right? Hilarious. And then we went to where I've been reading about my whole life. We went to Rome. I know more about Roman history than I do American history, like by far. Right? I got to walk the streets where the emperors walked, right? I got to see the whole power where Julius Caesar was created. You walk around a corner and there's something 2,000 years old. She took me to the Vatican. Art Museum, the Vatican Art Museum, right? And the special tour, right? She's like the most talented woman in the world, a travel art, travel agent extraordinaire, right? And she's my wife, right? How great is that? The guy running the tour was a trained dramatic actor. And he was going to school for exactly what he was showing us, right? Like art history. Right? So he had knowledge and presentation down, right? And I've got questions for him, right? Because I know him just enough to ask the right questions. So we're going through this whole tour. Some of the most beautiful, I'm an artist as well, right? Some of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. And I'm like drinking it in like, oh my God, oh my God. I got tired of oh my God, right? And the last thing we saw was the Sistine Chapel. Right? And I looked up and just lost my shit. I just lost it completely. I was sobbing. Right? I was sobbing. our travel guide just folded his arms and stepped back, right? So they had my job done right there. Like, I had never seen such beauty in my life. And I was thinking about where I've come from. My 6x8 cell.
Sistine Chapel. And God's doing with Adam what I've felt Him do in my life. And what I've seen Him do in your life repeatedly over and over and over again. And what I'm praying I see happen in the lives of the newcomers here tonight. He's just waiting on us. It's a way for me to surrender my sense of self, which I think is so important. It gets me in so much trouble. So I want to talk about this and I'll shut up. The last 2 years, as the world has become like a little more deeply aware of how fragile it is in all aspects, from medical on down, I have become aware, right, that there are parts of me that I didn't even know and still don't even know and have been getting in my way for a long, long time. I have had immense ability to build compartments, which keeps me safe from the world, right? I have my little things, which keeps me safe from the world and those. And I can always retreat because it can't be taken away from me because it's my secret. You know, and I've talked about these things, right, with various people and sponsors and friends throughout the years in AA, but never with the level of giving them up. Never with the level of, you know what, these are harmful to me and possibly harmful to those around me, and I've got to quit. Never at that level, right? And therefore, this is what's been occurring now. Since the last 2 years, these things have come. I had that dark night of the soul where I faced all this, and I have been like revelation is not even a word strong enough for what is, oh, I mean, I hate to use the word woke. I hate it, right? I hate that word, right? But I have awakened in a manner that it's like being born, spiritually born again. Right? I tried to be a Christian for a little while. I'm now attending a Calvary Church-based self-help group. Right? And I love these guys. I love these people. We don't have an exclusivity. I don't have any exclusivity. I'm trying to add a syllable. That's fine. On being people that are actively seeking God. We really don't. We've only come into it over the last, 85 plus years now. There's some people that have been doing it for a lot longer, and I need help. I need help in many areas. I have a counselor, right? I had to seek deeper help in the last 2 years. My counselor walked me through some really bad stuff that had happened since she started counseling. It wasn't even violent to her, but some bad stuff happened. You know, somebody really close to me killed themselves, man. And he was one of those guys. He got out of prison and doing his whole prison sentence. Right, he was just like me. He was a bank robber. He was an artist. He was a recovery member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a long-term sobriety in prison. And he got out. He couldn't stay sober, and he killed himself. Right, he was also an electrician, and I hired him the day he got out. Right, dang, you're hired. Come on, I fired him that day. And that day he killed himself. I'm like, okay, I know better, right? And the whole thing went down. He'd been using drugs on the job for this was his third time, and he knew 3 strikes, you're out, you know. And I said, well, for now, but let's do this. Let's get back. I did my absolute best, right? I'm a man, and I didn't make it my responsibility. But the pain of that, as open as I was to all everything else that had been going on in my life for the last year and a half before that, it floored me. I would break out just sobbing, like in the middle of driving.
You know what I mean? People look at you funny when you're like bawling when you're driving. It's almost as bad as I used to do this a lot, wear a little headlight at work, and I forget I got it on. And I get in, I start driving around. I'm like, why is everybody staring at me? I got the Cyclops headlights all the time. I'm so clueless. I really am. That's the last thing I'm going to say. I said that was it, but I want you guys to know that that family that I described, I'm right in the heart of it. I'm right in the heart of it. You've given me back to my mom and dad, back to my sister, back to my son that still have me. I'm here and I'm fully conscious and I'm awake in this world and I know who I am and I know who my God is. And I know that you are all my brothers and sisters, and I love you. Thank you very much.
All right, how about another round of applause for you?